Hello again, and welcome back to AIR, an interview podcast series with a different theme each episode. Before we get started today, just a quick reminder that you can follow us on Instagram at underscore AIR podcast, or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/AIR podcast. We'll also finally have a new semi-regular Substack newsletter sending out this week. You can sign up for that on airpodcast.substack.com. On to this month's episode, which welcomes Australian producer, composer, and sound artist Ben Frost. Early albums like his Theory of Machines, By the Throat, and Solaris established Ben Frost as a frontrunner in conceptual, boundary-pushing, and sometimes aggressive electronic music, echoed in his earth-shaking live performances, which themselves are celebrations of spine-tingling bass frequencies and volume. Not for the faint of heart, his music is inspired by punk rock guitar, minimalism, and in the case of his most recent album, heavy metal, often eschewing storytelling altogether in favor of a visceral, physical, musical experience. And yet, his work in film and TV scoring, dance, and even opera suggests he's still interested in narrative artwork. In this conversation, Ben and I explore the different facets of storytelling, or lack thereof, as a musician, his new album Scope Neglect, and his approach to composition across these decidedly different fields. Ben, thank you so much for joining me. I'm looking forward to speaking.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So I was reading an interview that you did with RA around the time that By the Throat came out.
Oh my God.
And in it, you said that you feel like your work is becoming less and less narrative. So in terms of your studio solo work, do you still feel that way almost 15 years later?
I'm just trying to imagine the context for me saying that. I think in some ways, probably what I was getting at there was like this, maybe less narrative was maybe not the right way to say it, but like an idea that somehow music was becoming less, the music was becoming less concerned with maybe traditional like forms of composition or even songwriting, I suppose, mm-hmm. at that point in time. You know, my whole sort of teenage years was spent in bands, you know, mm-hmm. playing guitar music. And, you know, the way I sort of fell into working with computers and sort of, I guess at this point in time, being very much identified as an electronic musician. I mean, that wasn't something I ever really decided upon or came at from that angle. It was more the use of computers in my music was initially, it became this thing of like, okay, replacing band members who went off and got married or went to law school or whatever. And I sort of ended up on my own, mm-hmm. ostensibly. And then little by little, that replacement of people became more about a relationship with machines and, you know, and playing, not only using the computer as a recording device, which originally that's how I was kind of approaching it, and it becoming more of a compositional thing. So I imagine like what I was sort of maybe toying with there was this idea that, you know, moving past through your machines and into By the Throat and beyond that, it sort of became more and more about pushing the limits of what was possible within computer music and within audio production, as opposed to really having a lot of focus on song structure or anything like that. By that stage, I think all that stuff it sort of fell by the wayside. And so I think in some ways that has certainly proven true. My primary interest is very much in sound and in the way sound works and the relationship between the sound and the ear and the kind of emotional connections across that void between the way we hear and the way we feel things. So that still rings true for me.
And so how is it to make music in that way, when you're not having to think about the structure as much? Are you creating through, just your own feeling, going with the flow and seeing what comes out? Is it a bit more sort of natural for you in that way?
I mean, with this record specifically, but maybe just more like in a kind of more holistic sense, I'm sort of looking more and more for ways to get a certain effect on myself as a listener with less, and with more dislocation or disconnection between elements, maybe reducing the amount of information in the music to kind of force a more challenging kind of listening space to be in. And this is speaking purely for myself. I mean, ultimately, like first and foremost, I think that the audience for, the music I'm making is me, in that I can't say I've really ever considered how it's going to fall on the ears of anyone else outside of, the studio I'm sort of working in. By setting up parameters to make records the way I do, bringing in certain people, going to certain places at certain times, and setting up this sort of bit of a rule book or setting up an experiment, as was the case with this new one, it kind of the rules are sort of defined from the outset, and what happens inside of those isn't completely within my control. It becomes this thing of like receiving what comes out of that and sort of taking it and going, okay, well, like how much of this is working the way I what is it about this thing that's now feeling right to me, or moreover, what is it about this thing that feels wrong to me? And often that wrong thing, like removing extraneous information or removing elements, like reveals this thing that whilst it isn't necessarily the thing that I exactly planned, it's now a thing that I'm interested in looking at or listening to, and it's not annoying me, if that makes sense. So it becomes this process of elimination, sort of chipping away at an object to make it feel sort of balanced somehow.
And is that something that you've come to just in terms of scope neglect, or is that sort of all the way, always the way that you work?
There's certainly things about the way I work now that are I can recognize the sort of the kernels of those ideas, even back, 20 years into the back catalog, and sort of go, okay, well, not a lot has changed there in terms of the kinds of things I'm interested in. That being said, I think that I can get to things quicker, I can get to ideas faster, but of course then that has its own sort of inherent problems wherein some of those instincts are very, they're often the easiest, like the sort of surface level stuff. So like getting to something new, means diving a lot deeper and kind of challenging how it is I work. I am a pretty terrible musician, honestly. Like I'm not a great, I don't play anything particularly well. My sort of knowledge of the structure of music is very rudimentary, and that works in my favor sometimes. But the thing is that where it becomes interesting for me is with this kind of limited tool set that I have, is to then keep applying it in a new environment, And by environment, I mean a new studio. It's a new place to work, and often it's just about surrounding myself with new people.
You also worked with a bassist and a guitarist for this album, is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, what was that like? You mentioned kind of jumping in with new people. Did that help to kind of give you, I don't know, some new ideas, new perspectives?
Yeah, I mean that like I think collaboration has definitely been a huge part of my working practice for, a long time now. But with this record, I had a very specific idea in mind of the kind of thing I wanted to do. I wanted to focus in on this idea of metal, I suppose, as a sort of a fundamental musical sort of ecology that I wanted to get inside of and sort of really dive into it. I mean, there's always been elements of that in my work, but with this one, I really wanted to go head first into it and sort of try and make something. I've been a metal fan all my life, and there's things I love about it, and there's a fascination I have with the mechanics of metal. But like any genre, there's metal carries with it a lot of baggage, and there's a lot of sort of there's some heavy tropes within it that to me, in some ways, get in the way of my ability to engage with it. Like some of the vocal stuff, especially in the lyrics, there's an aesthetic there that stands in front or shadows, casts a shadow on the music itself. And so I wanted to sort of find a way in to that while sort of assuming all the unnecessary parts. And there's this band from Long Island in New York called Carbomb, who are, really the bleeding edge of like progressive metal. And I've been a fan of them for years now. And I just, it really just came down to sending out some fan mail, really. And we made contact, and it very quickly became evident that he's first and foremost a fan of what I do, which was nice to hear. And so we started talking, and I invited him over to Berlin to work with me. And within that first couple of hours of meeting, it was very clear that a huge part of why his music, I think, resonates with me is, and vice versa, is there is a sort of a shared love of a lot of commonalities in music. Like he's a huge Ortega fan, and like he's an electronic music head. That's kind of where he's coming from. And when you don't know that, I don't think you really pick up on it. But as soon as that becomes clear, you hear it immediately in the music, and the way he's kind of shape shifting through these songs is it very much has its roots in a lot of really great electronic music. And so like there was a rapport there pretty quickly. And so for me, that was a there was a very easy way to sort of get into that relationship and sort of start to speak the same language.
Earlier in your answer, you mentioned how metal has this kind of connotation, or people have these prejudgments about it. And I was reading in another interview that you did about Aurora, where you said that there was this line about how it was about your time spent in the Congo, but people really took that and ran with it. And you felt like that wasn't really what it was all about. So is it worrying for you to talk about how this new album is influenced by metal, and worrying, that people are going to bring those kind of connotations to it, or have these prejudgments about it based on that?
I mean, at this point in time, the sort of the narrative, the narrative of an album, either real or totally constructed, often becomes kind of the defining color or lens through which people hear the music, unfortunately or fortunately, whichever way you want to sort of look at it. In a perfect world, I think that releasing music and saying nothing about it and just allowing it to sort of be what it is, and you would like to think that it would be obvious what it is, and how it should kind of feel, or how it does feel. And I think on some level that is true, and it's always been a source of mystery to me and kind of fascination, the way that, as I sort of release a record into the world, it becomes like a teenager, and it just goes off on its own path and makes its own way, kind of in spite of me. I'm sure a lot of other musicians would feel that same way. It's like the places that, you know, my music pops up and resonates with people. It's fascinating. That being said, I mean, the other side of that is that often it can somehow get, I don't know, painted into a bit of a corner.
With the text that came along with Scope Neglect, I found I was like, before I listened to the album, I was really reading the text and trying to, figure out what it was going to sound like. And I wasn't sure if metal meant music or metal, like the sound of like sheet metal or something like that. So I spent a lot of times kind of thinking about it. And then when I actually listened to it, I kind of just forgot about all of that. And I wasn't focusing on what it's supposed to be about. I just listen to it and let myself kind of feel it. Is that sort of what you're hoping for? That your music is just kind of evoking some kind of emotion rather than being explained by, whatever text or whatever line?
I don't know if you've ever been to the Roscoe Room at the Tate in London.
Mm-mm.
It's always struck me as a strange experience to walk into that room that really, like, the scale of those paintings, the weight of them, it's such a palpable atmosphere that immediately sort of envelops you as you walk in. And yet, the first thing to greet you isn't the painting, it's the little didactic on the wall telling you how the painting's supposed to make you think about it. It's a strange language that we've set up as a species, this sort of curatorial overture that's required for consumption of everything is yeah, it's strange, it's frustrating. And at the same time, there's something really alluring, and there's a bit of a dopamine hit in it somewhere in there as well. I find myself doing the same thing. You know, you walk through a gallery, and in spite of the work itself being there on the wall, if there is a text next to it, inevitably you're sort of pulled towards that. I don't know what that says about us, that we need the context, we need the.
Yeah. To me, it seems like you, with the, we've been talking a little bit about storytelling, and it seems to me like you would rather give people sort of subtle hints about what you're trying to say rather than just like spoon feeding it to them with a text or like an overt explanation. For example, that your track titles are quite like mysterious, I think. And I think that you actually work quite hard on your track titles.
Yeah, you know, making music that's non-lyrical, there is a sort of fleeting opportunity, you know, in the way that things are titled, to maybe add weight in a certain direction. And you know, I'm a reader. I love to read, and you know, I love poetry, I love prose. That's always been kind of an element of songwriting, I suppose, in a way that's most appealed to me, is the way, you know, titles feel. Some of my favorite music often has great titles. I've always really enjoyed that process of weaving those threads together, and they really do require weaving. The way I tend to work and have worked over the years now is that the titles often just sort of they're sort of hanging around in presence of the music, but not necessarily tied to it in a definitive way. You know, there's a body of music I'm working on, and there's things I'm reading in that period. And you know, we're talking maybe 1 or 2 years of the process. And whatever it is that I'm kind of consuming inevitably sort of finds its way into that. And at some point, as it reaches the finish line, those things really start to talk to one another, and I start trying them out. And certain tracks just seem to pull, like, you know, there's this sort of magnetism between phrasing and sound, and they pull to one another. But then, of course, as then you start to form a track listing of the thing, then it becomes more of an editorial process of like, well, okay, well, this thing as a whole, it's like that thing has that title, but you know, if I'm going to put that on as the third piece, and it's got this long title, and then the thing that I want to put forth also has this really long title. If those things don't make sense, then I actually often will go back and change one of them so that the weighting is different, and there's a sort of an overall shape that I'm looking for. And again, it's mostly just about removing a thing that feels off. It's never about like looking for a specific shape. It's just about kind of chiseling away at the bits that are sticking out.
Is it difficult to find the balance between all of those things, like music that makes you feel something but that isn't overtly telling, a really literal story, but also has these interesting titles that look nice but also aren't giving away too much, not being too didactic? Like, it seems like a lot of things to think about.
I mean, sometimes it's really fun to just be able
Yeah.
to, like make like to color a piece of music in a really specific and kind of heavy-handed way, and to kind of contrast those things. I mean, there was a on the album before this one, The Center Cannot Hold, there's a song on there that's it's not even a song. It's a it's like a like 20 seconds long or something. It was just this thing that I needed in between these other things. It was a piece to just provide like a breath of energy between these two other pieces of music. And that thing needed a title because that's the way the digital world works. You can't not get a name. And I called it A Single Hellfire Missile Costs $100,000.
I remember, yep.
That piece of music has nothing to do with that idea. It was just a, it's just a, it's like a, it's an absurd, disgusting statistic. I don't know. It just felt like a kind of a piece of like factual information that I just really wanted to see like in black and white, and have it kind of, and have it printed like thousands of times on, CD and vinyl covers, and have it splashed all over, Spotify playlists. It just felt to me like something that needed to be said. I don't consider myself to be a particularly sort of politically active person, but like that little, like that was just like a glancing blow at that idea. And so, I mean, I think that's one way to think about language and titles and how they can kind of affect things. And then the other way is to just kind of have something that sort of speaks directly to, to the idea of what music feels like. And that for me is less common, to your point of the sort of the didactic nature of titles. It's more interesting for me to pose questions. How do you bridge that gap? Because I think as an audience, that's where it gets more engaging as a listener, is how do I put these things together?
Maybe we can talk a bit more about the like creative and production techniques that you used on this album. We were talking earlier about, music that makes you really feel something, that's really effective, that has this kind of intense sonic impact. I know in the past, well, I read this in an article about you that, one time you used this method of like slashing tape with a razor blade while recording to get this kind of different sound. So I wondered what kind of interesting production or creation techniques you used with Scope Neglect that maybe helped craft this intense sound that we've been talking about.
This record is really for me a lot about negative space, and maybe more than the other records. I think like when I listen back to some of the earlier records, they are pretty crowded there's a density issue there in some of it, and I think is I think for whatever reason that appealed to me at various points in time to kind of like just keep adding, or like there's a layering effect that's going on there. I think this record probably is the leanest by far, insofar as there's less going on. You know, it's just a prog it's a natural progression, perhaps. Like there's a I'm less comfortable in that space, and that kind of excites me, like the idea of having less things to lean on, you know, less elements, and by bringing singular elements forward and allowing them a lot of air around them, it brings out like an inherent sort of like the muscularity of certain things, the skeletal kind of nature of a sound comes forward, and there's more room for detail. The way I was sort of getting to that, you know, was partly just due to the you know, one of the inherent ideas of the record was to sort of take these sort of elements of metal, like these familiar elements, and to isolate them a little bit. So one of the things I was doing in the studio was I knew that Greg specifically was coming in from an environment of, you know, a metal guitarist. He comes from a band. He's used to having a drummer like smashing away behind him, and here I was sort of inviting him into this, you know, sort of experimental electronic music space. And I was very conscious that I didn't want him to change his approach based on my influence. I wanted him to sort of do what he does, and so I very purposely built pretty elaborate kind of orchestrations in this music. You know, drums and you know, chord changes and big, you know, big arrangements with a lot of like weight to them, that were purely for the purpose of kind of driving a certain kind of performance from him, but knowing full well from the outset that I had every intention of deleting those as soon as he'd kind of performed to them. So what my hope was, I think, is that by him responding to this really big arrangement, this big full sound, is that he would sort of be more willing to allow negative space around himself. Because I know myself as a performer, there is a tendency there when you're isolated as a performer, there's a tendency to do too much, because silence is scary, you know. Emptiness is scary, and so you feel this need to be busy, and busyness in that context sort of translates to playing too much. And so I didn't want that to happen. I wanted Greg to kind of feel like he could play and then stop and have lots of sort of negative space in between his phrases. He'd be happy to do that because there would be so much else going on. And then, of course, you know, after he'd recorded, I would then go in and just mute everything. He'd be sort of left hanging there. I think the effect of that is it creates a different kind of silence, because there's an awareness in his performance of a sort of architecture that, you know, we can't see or hear, but I think you sort of feel it. The silence is pregnant with awareness of something. It's like there's these ghosts in the room with him.
How do you envision touring this album if, or like, do you envision kind of trying to somehow recreate that same situation somehow?
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that, because it is something we've been playing with a lot, like feeding him a drum track that actually isn't there for the, you know,
For the
for the
audience,
audience. I mean, it's less of a it's definitely less of an issue now, because he already knows those pieces of music, and you know, with the, like he understands what I'm getting at. But in that moment, I think initially there was a much bigger disconnect between him and I. I mean, we were literal strangers, like in the studio. I mean, we'd never met before. The engineer that I worked with at Candy Bomber in Berlin, his name is Ingo Kraus. He's a remarkable man. We spent a lot of time just kind of trying to get a sound, and get something that felt right. Like recording an empty room there's a lot of power in that, in recording a space that where live amplifiers are sort of they're sort of waiting. It's like all this potential energy in that, and that feels very different to me. There's a live element in the record that feels new to me, and so we've been trying to keep a lot of that in the live version of it as well, to sort of bring in this thing where it feels like we're still playing around. Like it's not set in stone at all. Like it's very much a kind of an organic thing. It can re go, I mean, the live version of it can go really wrong really fast.
What else can you tell me about live performance and how, being in front of a crowd and having that energy changes things for you? I was reading an article about one of your performances of The Center Cannot Hold, and the author wrote that it almost looked like you were fighting your machines because you were really kind of pushing everything so much, and there was this really sort of intense energy. So is that how it feels for you when you're playing live?
I mean, I've definitely set things up in a pretty deliberate way to be difficult, honestly, because for me that's what live music is about. I mean, there is a it's a funny thing to kind of see from the outside, because I think objectively, from the audience perspective, visually, there's very little difference between myself and a DJ. Like none, really, in fact. I mean, let's be honest, it's just a guy standing behind a table. It's not that interesting, but I would like to think that there's an energy there that feels palpably different because of the risk involved. There is a lot of there's an inherent risk in making live music the way that I do, which is, as you say, it is very much about sort of setting up this sort of ecosystem of interconnected ideas, objects, and software and then you add a live guitarist into that, and that system is feeding into mine, and vice versa, and then all of the audio visual aspect of it as well with the visual artist Tarek Bari, who I'm working with. There's a huge kind of feedback loop, and it's a really sort of biological system where one thing is affecting the next. And that is super exciting. And when it goes well, it goes well. It's fun to be a part of that and to feel that you're inside of it. And that battling idea that you're talking about, it's a real thing. It really does feel like that sometimes. But I mean, the opposite, side of that coin is that it sometimes goes really wrong.
Does that battling feeling, does that also extend to your audience? You did an interview where you talked about how your music is sort of masochistic, that like it fires up all these really primal emotions that we all love and seek out in things like, bungee jumping, for example. So do you like making your audience have these kind of big reactions or feel this really big energy or this battle that you just mentioned?
Look, I'm perpetually sort of perplexed and extremely grateful for the fact that I even have an audience, to be perfectly honest. The thrill-seeking aspect of live music, and specifically, when we're talking about volume and bass frequencies, pushing PAs to their limit, working within this sort of physical sound space is, it is a thrill, and I never get tired of it, and it's really addictive. As time has sort of gone on, I think I would like to think got better at sort of harnessing that energy and working with systems like that. But inevitably, there's some sort of short circuit in my brain where the second something gets comfortable, I start to become bored with it. So that is always kind of pushing me to keep pushing the envelope, whatever that might be. keep sort of carving into things further and further, and making the sort of the relationships within music and within sound to kind of have more and more complexity, so that there is this feeling that, I don't know, trying to sort of breathe life into something that is ostensibly it's not a living entity, but I kind of want it to feel that way. And so, working with software that injects, certain randomness into a system is exciting to me. Working with sort of interconnectivity, either through sidechain compression or envelope following, things that allow one element to affect another, and then cross-pollinating through, through various channels, to kind of create this ecosystem of interconnectivity that I think creates like an overall space wherein I'm inviting an audience into that with me, and I'm ultimately asking for trust from an audience that I know what I'm doing. If you stick with me, I'm gonna take you somewhere that I want to go, that I think is interesting and sort of emotionally satisfying.
You mentioned the kind of thrill that people get when they come to your shows, but I wonder if that's also how it feels for you when you're making your music. Like, are you also feeling, invigorated and thrilled and like a little bit maybe overwhelmed or scared or, those big emotions?
Yeah, I mean, I know exactly when something is good, and it's just a feeling. It's usually just that the hair on the back of my neck stands up, and there's this feeling that it activates some brainstem emotional state that just says, yes, this is elemental. I've really, outside of music, I've really only ever experienced that in nature, and for me, the two are very much connected. So being close to a volcanic eruption, or being in the ocean in the waves, being in a space where there is a sort of a sublime surrender is kind of a space that I always want to be in. And when that happens in a studio setting, specifically, within, my own music, that's it. That's why I do it.
I wonder if you feel like there's also a time and a place for more straight up, like narrative storytelling, musical composition. Obviously, something like working on the soundtrack to a film or a dance performance or an opera is a bit more literal in the storytelling sense, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a time and a place for that, for sure. If honestly, there's probably too much time, too many places that I've kind of committed to that space. I mean, specifically, film music. Film music is a it's a very slippery slope, writing music for film. It's highly addictive, and sort of weirdly, yeah, it's seductive in that being given a reason to write something, having a linear narrative in front of you that's saying, this is what I need. Like, I need this thing that you're making to follow this shape. or to support this idea, or to drive this particular story. These two people on the screen are in love, and you need to remind everybody that that's
What's
what
happening?
they are. Like, that's, all of that is thrilling, and when it works, I mean, some of my favorite moments in music are, film score for sure. But yeah, it has a detrimental effect on making music for music's sake, at least in my life, in my experience.
I was going to say, I could imagine it was kind of like, there's areas where you have to be a bit more linear, and then when you come to back to a studio album, it can be whatever it wants, and it doesn't even really have to make sense, and maybe that's really freeing, maybe.
I mean, in theory, that's how it should work. In my experience, and I know from talking to, from talking to my friends and peers who are film music makers, it is a common thing that I think it tends to, first and foremost, it sucks energy out of the creative process. It's ultimately, I mean, when we're talking about something like Dark, I mean, over if you take every cue from Dark and you put it back end to end, I mean, we're talking well over 10 hours of music. I mean, that's the Beatles back catalog, that's it's an insane amount of music. And so, you come out the other end of that, a shell of the artist you went in as, and kind of getting back to a space where there's energy again to give to music, that takes time. And then sort of coming off the drug that is, writing music for a film, that's a whole other time thing as well. I mean, I think it took me a lot of time after that huge stint of working in Hollywood film score. It really kind of It took a lot of time and a lot of honestly pretty shitty music to kind of get to a space where I was like, okay, this is interesting again. Like, this is now I'm engaged.
How did all of that shift when you were the one in charge, doing your first two operas? Did you have to change the way you thought, or change your approach in general because you were the one saying, at what moment do we need to be reminded that two characters are in love, or which parts need what kind of music?
Opera is such a funny space to work in, because it on some level it's highly traditional, and it's a kind of a misunderstood space because of that. I think in that it the system of opera houses is, it's one of the only, perhaps the only space on earth that is truly designed around music. The needs of music. Everything about the world of opera is in servitude of music, which, when you contrast that with pretty much any other art form, music is there to support everything else. Whereas in an opera house, everything is there to support music. The story of an opera, like whatever that might be, like whether it's a really bad one or a really good one, the libretto is the thing that kind it you don't really see it until you're working in that space, but it's so deeply embedded in the architecture and the bureaucracy of an opera house that everybody is just kind of working around the needs of the music and the musicians and the composer. And so it is a thrilling space to work in that, I found these stories that I was sort of interested in, and being able to sort of deliver those stories through music and through sound. What's really fun about it is that, being on both sides of that relationship, like, being able to direct the staging of the thing and also write the music, it kind of puts me in this unique space where I can leave spaces in the music for certain things to happen visually, and vice versa. So there's a sort of there's they're playing off on each other. I can kind of leave a lot more room, and so that changes the way the whole thing is written. as well. And that feels very different to me to film music, because with film there's no dialogue, there's no the more often than not when I'm working on music for film, the film has already been shot. It's not going to talk back to me. It's not going to change depending on my influence on it. Whereas that's not true in an opera stage. You can really play around with things. I can change the way the image looks, and I can change the way an actor kind of delivers a thing based on the way it sounds, and vice versa.
Earlier in the conversation, we were talking about, like not necessarily trying to spoon feed people with, this whole explanation, about what your music means or what your music is about. And so, are you finding that difficult with opera that kind of has to have this more sort of concept that's out there in the world and that people are kind of coming to see this story play out on stage, if that makes sense?
With the last opera, which was it's called The Murder of Halit Yozgat. It's based on a counter investigation of a crime which occurred in Germany, actually. Basically, the assassination of a Turkish immigrant by a neo-Nazi in an internet cafe in Kassel. The thing that really fascinated me about the case was this idea that you have this enclosed space, this cafe, and within that space you have seven participants, none of whom are talking to one another or concerned with one another. Some of them were on phone calls, international phone calls, and so there's these conversations occurring through this space, but they're all happening in silence. Music is a really interesting way to portray that, and how conversations are kind of flowing across one another, and how the phrasing and the distancing of those conversations, how certain phrases from one conversation can actually then bleed into another one. The conversations themselves are sort of getting mixed up. They're getting kind of complicated by their proximity to one another. Also you had this Secret Service agent sort of in the space who was claiming to have not heard a gunshot he was at very close proximity to. And so I thought, this is a really unique opportunity that where music and perhaps putting music, like in an opera setting on a stage, can convey an idea that we can't really do justice to in a YouTube video or any other kind of media. Because if I say to you, okay, this gunshot was 148 decibels at 5 meters, that's a really arbitrary idea. I think people understand to an extent that, okay, yeah, that's loud, but how loud is that? Like, what does that actually mean? And working in the sphere that I work in, I was in a unique position to sort of say, well, actually, I do know how loud that is, and I'm going to show you. And so for you to read that in a Guardian article is one thing. To actually then be in the 25th row of an opera house and to look at a man sitting on a chair next to a speaker which has been calibrated specifically to recreate 148 decibels with the actual gunshot recording from a forensic investigation team fired out of that speaker towards him on stage, and to watch that actor not react at all to this thing that you can clearly hear from row 25, that's a kind of storytelling that goes far beyond the abilities of digital media.
Is that also how you feel about your live performances as a musician? Like giving people something else, something more than what they could hear on their, home speakers or some more tangible way of understanding you as an artist.
I think that the nature of live performance for me is unfortunately massively influenced by space. So like where I'm playing and what that room looks like, feels like, sounds like, hugely affects what happens on stage. It's not this kind of like roll in, roll out Coldplay show, you know, like that is just the same no matter where it's happening. I mean, for me, it's a journey of sort of, you know, exploring different aspects of the material. I don't know. I don't know if there's any. I'm sure there's no fundamental or definitive version of me on stage. It's pretty. It's always changing, I think. And what it feels like on a Tuesday is sometimes very different to how it feels on a Wednesday. But that's the best thing about live music.
Would you say that performing live is kind of where you become your most sort of storyteller self? Like that's where things are most effective for you in terms of what you want to do as an artist or what you want to say as an artist or how you want to say it?
I think it's fair to say that that's probably the space I feel like the most sense of responsibility to kind of create a narrative, I suppose, in a way, like to make something that feels like it has the right proportions within that environment, within that space and time. You know, you've got an audience sitting there, standing there in front. It definitely carries a different sort of weight to it for me.
Do you think that having all these different outlets for your music, you know, both narrative and non-narrative, is that essential for you as an artist, like getting to scratch all those different itches?
Yeah, I definitely don't do well with being sort of stuck in one space with one thing to do. There's definitely a lot of different things I'm interested in, for different reasons, and that tends to move in sort of phases. I think that being able to kind of work across a variety of different kind of mediums and with different collaborators, and that definitely suits me. I understand very well though that that's not the case for everyone. Sometimes kind of wish it wasn't the case for me as well. It can be exhausting having my brain go in 20 different directions at once. But for the most part, I get more out of it than it takes out of me.
You've been listening to Ben Frost for Air episode 65. We'll be back on the last Wednesday of the month, so check back in April for another episode. In the meantime, don't forget you can follow us on Instagram at underscore air podcast, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/airpodcast, or sign up for our semi-regular Substack newsletter at airpodcast.substack.com. See you in April, and thanks for listening.